Hello world, I'm Hank Key and welcome to the Personal Computer Show, the original personal computer radio show. This is a pre-recorded broadcast. More than half the workers say they rely on apps to make ends meet. Around 56% of this, what we call the gig economy, say that the income they get from those services is essential to making ends meet. This is according to a Pew Research which interviewed about 5,000 workers from various app-based services like Dial-A-Ride, cleaning, laundry, food and grocery delivery apps. And Pew estimates that 8% of adults in the United States earn money working in such services. The survey found that the majority of workers did not see their gig economy as luxury income or, you know, extra money, but it was vital income. 56% of those surveyed classified their earnings as essential or important parts of their budget, while 44% said the gig money was nice to have and not a key part of their total income. Researchers also found that 32% of those surveyed were unemployed outside of their gig work, while 44% were otherwise employed full-time and 24% had part-time jobs in addition to their gig work. In the case of gig work, as what they call it, workers who describe the income they earn from these platforms are essential and important and more likely to come from low-income households, to be non-white, and to have not attended college. They are less likely to perform online tasks for pay, but more likely to gravitate towards physical tasks such as ride-hailing or cleaning and laundry. The National Retail Federation released Black Friday survey data, and according to the association, there's an estimate of 137.4 million people who are planning to shop this weekend. And this is up from last year by about percentage point. And for which days would be the busiest this weekend? Black Friday is definitely still the day that would draw the most traffic, with 74% of the people that responded to the survey. And only 21% said that they head out on Thursday night, the lowest total of any of the 4 days of the holiday weekend. Great news for small and local businesses out there. Of the 47% who said they plan to shop on Saturday of this weekend, 24% said they specifically are planning to go out and support Small Business Saturday. They're coming up with all these shopping days. They shop on Thursday, which is Thanksgiving. Friday is Black Friday. We had Cyber Monday. And now Saturday is called Small Business Saturday. Well, last week I had touched on Black Friday, and I have a little more detail to give you, and I'll give you what my thoughts are. The only thing I know about Black Friday is that there's a lot of speculation about what may or may not be available on Friday, but the only known fact I know of is Dell.com, in other words, Dell Computer, will make available Inspiron 11-inch 3000. It normally sells for $200, bit with $199.95. I call it $200. Okay, that's their regular price. And they'll be selling it for half that price. And the configuration of that system is that it has a Celeron processor, which is about four times the speed of original Atom chip. So anyone who has a netbook running an Atom chip, this will give you a good idea of how fast your machine is. And for most people, if all you're doing is light office work or just browsing on the internet, it'll do the work. It's equipped with 32 gig, not 16 gig with these low-end systems. And let me just say that with card storage, it's not the same as solid-state storage. Solid-state storage is much faster, but card storage is faster. Well, let's say it can be the equivalent depending on what the speed of the memory is. And on with this system, I have no idea. There's no marking on it. There's no way of knowing. But let's say it's about a hard disk speed as opposed to solid state speed. So, but it's limited, and it has 32 gigs, and that's good. You could put the operating system on it, but it's well equipped though. It comes with a micro SD port on it. The micro SD port will enable you to put 64 gig, and if you're willing to pay a little more, 128 gig of external storage. Now, as you know, you have no idea what the real speed is. But hey, this is a functional thing you're looking for. You're not looking for a gamer. You're not looking for something that is going to, you know, burn the roof and get things done quickly. You know, if something sells for $100 brand new, you use it for fun. HDMI display port, that's good. It comes with a USB 3.0 port, USB 2.0 port, And it also comes with Bluetooth, and it comes with Wi-Fi. Pretty reasonably equipped. Now, you can get it from Dell.com, which is Dell Computers. But it's going to be made available on Thanksgiving Day. But most people, they don't realize that on Thanksgiving Day, it's not at midnight. In other words, when the clock becomes midnight, that's not when it's available. It's available 6 p.m. Eastern Time. So if you're interested in the unit, start calling a few minutes before 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Of course, if you're eating a turkey, you may forget it, or you're eating your favorite Thanksgiving food. Well, listen, you know, it's only a computer. It comes available in three colors, red, white. Yeah, what do you think the third color is? Blue, red, white, or blue. And they said that when the specified on-sale quantity runs out, it goes back up to $200. So that's available. Now, that's the only thing I know for sure in the computing area of what, you know, what is really available. On the net itself, there's a lot of talk about Chromebooks being available for $95. Early in the day, I had spoken to Joe King, and he's not able to be on tonight. I said to him, Joe, if you could buy a Chromebook, let's say similarly equipped, but not necessarily, you know, with a 32 gig of card storage, but maybe 16 for $95, or Windows. By the way, this comes installed with Windows 10 Home for, let's say, $100. What would you buy? Well, I had a different answer than his. I'll give you his answer. His answer is he'll buy a Chromebook. Why? Well, it's simple to use, and if anything goes wrong, you could do a factory reset. And I think from his point of view, he recommends that only because he doesn't want any phone calls. In my case, my recommendation is find out who lives near you who can help you with using Windows or the Chrome operating system. In my case, I will probably maybe get one of both if I can. Why? Well, I got granddaughters, and when I'm finished playing with it, I don't want to use it, a trickle down. It sounds a little demeaning, but yeah, it's a trickle down process. One of the things I do want to talk about is a flash card memory. It's slow. Now, one of the things that I have discovered in looking at low-end notebooks is how they're configured. You got to read the specs very, very carefully, all right? And sometimes it's just not available. One of the things you want to know is the memory soldered on? If the memory's soldered on, you can't upgrade the memory. There's no way of upgrading the memory unless you want to get a soldering iron and start desoldering and make sure you don't lift any LANs and so on. For all practical purposes, it's not the way to go. Make sure that you look at some of these low-end offerings, whether the memory's soldered on. The other is check very carefully whether it's 16 gig or 32 gig, and you may not have a choice for the price, but you know, obviously you wanted to get the 32 gig. The Windows 10 operating system uses about 12 gigs, 12 to 15 gigs. And if you have 16 gigs, basically you use it up for the operating system. And part of the Windows 10 operating system is virtual paging. So basically you've used up the whole thing. With a 32 gig flash card, yeah, you're going to end up using the whole thing for the operating system, but you're going to run faster because you have space for the virtual paging. So that's something to think about. I don't care whether you buy a Windows machine or Chrome machine, but you want to use a flash card. You know, you could buy USB flash drives, no name or brand name. You could buy flash memory cards, no name or brand name. And I'm going to talk about notebook battery replacement, assuming you're able to replace the battery. And to some extent, smartphone battery replacement. Let's talk about batteries first. I had originally this summer, I had a little tiny camera, and boy, I loved that camera. And it was, but you know, after what, 8 years of usage, the battery just finally gave out. And so I went to B&H Photo Video and I got a replacement battery. And the salesman said to me, you want the original battery or you want a knockoff? I said, what's the difference? He says, well, one is $40 and the other one's $20. Okay, I'll take the knockoff, all right? And he says, it's for the camera. Well, I look at the card and, the voltage was correct. The form factor was correct. In other words, it fits. In other words, unlike flashlight batteries and unlike car batteries, which is a set physical size, and they fit the chemistry within that size, with notebooks and cameras, it's the other way around. They design the equipment and they build batteries to fit the equipment. And so what happens is that the battery you buy for this notebook won't fit other notebooks. The battery you buy for this smartphone won't fit another smartphone. And the battery you buy for this digital camera is not going to fit any other digital camera unless it's the same model. Let's see now. I bought the battery in the summertime and it went dead on me last week. And what happened was that if it just went dead, it would have been easier for me. But it did deteriorate. There is a factor in batteries called wear, the wear factor. The wear factor is that the battery consists of three parts. You have the voltage to consider. In other words, what is the voltage of the battery? The other is the capacitance. And the capacitance is measured in milliamps or amps. And together, when you multiply voltage and amps, you get watts. And watts is the power you need to run a unit. Now, you find very often that there is a margin of error, margin of design, so that let's say you had a flashlight and you had another flashlight, and let's say one flashlight uses a AAA battery and the other one uses a AA battery, and you use you turn the flashlight on at the same time. The AA battery will last longer than the AAA battery because the capacitance is a lot less. In other words, the milliamps is less on it, and it wears down faster. Now, when you talk about camera equipment or even notebooks for that matter, if the amperage on it, or milliamps, depending on the design of the battery, is slightly less or less than what it should be, the wear factor is going to increase very rapidly. So what happened to me was I just took the salesman word for it, and what happened was that the battery I bought should have been 1145 milliamps, and this one was rated 900. So it's less. Did it work in the beginning? Yes. And then I noticed that there was a slight shift in color. Now, when it's like anything else, if the wattage is not what it is, you don't get the exact same color, you don't get the exact same performance. And then when a digital camera dies, it doesn't die immediately. You may be able to turn on the camera, in other words, the lens will pop out, but the LCD screen may not go on because there's not enough power for it. And for the 2 weeks, I'm scratching my head, what could be wrong? Is it the camera or what? And then after doing more research on it, then I realized what it was. Now, am I saying if you had a choice of an original manufacturer battery or a knockoff battery, what should you buy? Very simple. I would opt for the original manufacturer battery, even if it costs more. And if you happen to have important pictures that you need to take, such as weddings or graduation or births or, something very important, or you're going on a cruise or you're going on a big major trip, hey, you want something that's reliable. Now, is it bad to not have a knockoff? No. By the way, a knockoff does have a purpose. The reason why I say that knockoff has a purpose is that if you can buy the original battery, do it. If you can buy original battery for the notebook, do it, okay? Now, when the manufacturer switches to another model, he doesn't give a darn about the, what the battery is. The product life cycle is over. You want to buy a battery, go buy it from someone else. And you end up buying a third party, a knockoff, a white box one, be it for a notebook or for a camera. Well, you're going to get what you get. And it's not going to last long at all, or at last as long as the other ones. But you know what? At least it's usable. Now, there's a corollary to all this. You'll find that manufacturers will, and this is typical with USB flash drives and flash memory cards and even notebook batteries. The variable is they have to come up with a voltage. That's fine. That's fixed. The controller is fixed, all right? In other words, the interface. But when it comes to capacitance, if it doesn't quite measure up, well, it no longer becomes a brand name item. They sell it off to in the gray market, and then someone else would then market differently and sell it. And that, and so you will end up with what I don't want to use the word inferior, but let's say a lower rated product. However, if his yield meaning the amount of inventory that he creates is great, ends up being greater than what he expected, it's very possible that when you buy it from a knockoff company or third party company, that it meets all the requirements. So this is something that you can find out. Now, on a notebook, when we talk about the wear factor, there's a program, at least for Windows that I'm aware of, is called HW Info 32 or 64, whether depending on whether you run a 32 operating system or a 64-bit operating system. It's a great program. What it does is that it gives you the ability to determine what is the wear factor. And it turns out the wear factor on the capacitance of the batteries is every time you charge it up, you lose capacitance every time you charge it up. And if you have a smart circuit, you hope it does the work, but, you know, a smart circuit costs money. And with the manufacturers, especially on the low end, every penny counts, and you can shave a, you know, 10 cents here, a dollar there. But a real good system, when they charge it up, they do three things, okay? One is they do not charge it 100%, although they may call it 100%, they charge it 90%. If you charge it 100%, you start affecting the wear factor faster. That's number one. Number two is when you use a battery, don't bring it all the way down. They recommend that when the battery wear factor gets to, in terms of usage, like 60, 50%, start recharging it. Don't bring it all the way down. Or if you do because you're running a test, just do it once or twice, but don't do it on a regular basis. And the other thing, of course, is you got to be careful you don't overcharge it. Now, the more expensive notebooks is when you are charging, or even smartphones, when you're charging the battery, when it's completely charged up to that level of 90% or 100%, it cuts it off. However, the cheaper stuff, it keeps charging, and you can feel the heat. Now, with the notebook, if you run this program running Windows, HW Info 32 or HW Info 64, it will tell you what the wear factor is. However, with a camera, there is a way of testing and determining the wear factor on a camera battery, but it's very, for the average person, forget about it. In other words, it's not a simple process. You won't have the patience to do it. There's a lot of tests. There's a lot of things you have to do. I don't recommend it. So like anything else, if you have something important and you just need it, like say you're going on a trip or you're taking your computer with you, bring along an extra battery. What kind of battery? Try to get the original. And like anything else, test it before you take it with you. Because just because it's a new battery, there's two things you got to remember with a new battery. It's not fully charged. It's about 60% charge. You got to charge it up. Make sure it works. I would say 99.9% of all batteries work, you know, immediately. But you don't want to be part of Murphy's Law that if it can fail, it's always with you. There is no standards of measurement. I'm sorry, there's standards of measurement. There's no standard of labeling. There's no standard of B rating and so on. So when you buy a brand name item like SanDisk, well, I don't want to get into too many names, okay? But you might buy a brand name one, all right? You'll find that they tend to be much faster in read and write. With when the standards of the read and write speed is not met, they sell it off in the gray market, and it's then relabeled, and you get another name on it. The other thing with someone had said to me, boy, this stuff must be good now because things have changed. And what has changed is that in the old days, when you bought a hard disk drive, they would say, they tell you how many bad spots there are, how many bytes are bad, considered bad. And then they're, you know, under program control, you block it off so you never use it. So when you start looking at it, have you noticed that if you bought the same model USB flash drive or even hard disk and you do a test to see how much capacity there is, real capacity, you're never going to find two of the same model having the same identical capacity because it's done prior to its sale. I find that the USB flash drives, whatever the rating is, it's never that rating. A brand name item is within 5%. In other words, it's 5% less than what the rating is. With clone stuff or knockoff items, it could be as low as, when I say low, the non-usable is 15% less than what the rating is. Now, well, I think, I'll name names, all right? With Micro Center, I find that their read-write speed is good. It's very usable. They're both in the double-digit area. However, I find that they're like 10% to 12% below rated capacity. So obviously, they don't manufacture this stuff. So you know, it's a house brand. It's a label brand. But so long as you know it. Now, as a general rule with flash drives, you have this total capacity. Let's say you bought a 32 gig flash drive, and it comes out to be 28. Well, it's really very rare that you actually have a job or a file that exceeds 28 gigabytes on first use. If you do, go get yourself the 64 and you'll get about 50 out of it, okay, or 50 plus out of it. So that's not the issue there. Kingston, I find to be pretty high standards. So what I do now is every time I have, I open a new pack of flash drives, I run a speed test on it. And even on brand name items, they will vary. Now, there are a couple of possibilities. You have good read, you have good write. I put those one side. Those are golden to me because I can use it for whatever purpose. I get good speed reading and writing. Then you have what is very good read speed but lousy write. And then you have the other is very good write speed but lousy read. Okay, now they're still very usable. In other words, if I am storing a... I'm backing up a program I bought, and I just want to put it onto a flash drive. Let's say I have a Windows distribution. I want to put it on a USB flash drive. I want it to be very good in read speed because basically when I'm using it, it's really somewhat permanent, and the speed is important in terms of reading. Writing, you're not going to write onto that. Now, if I'm doing backup, I want to back up my files, you really want excellent write speed so that you can do your backup as quickly as possible. Reading, okay. If when I need the backup, how often do I really need the backup? Rare, so I can tolerate the low read speed, but I really want the high write speed. Now, that leaves the fourth option, lousy read, lousy write. I keep them. Now, can I tell you what I keep them for? I get a lot of requests for people who say, can I have that picture or can I you give me this or that? Well, I pull out these flash drives and I put it on slow read, slow write. And actually, only one person ever said to me, you gave me a lousy flash drive. I says, you mean the information wasn't good? No, the information was there, but it is slow. It is for reading. It's slow for writing. So I said to him, what do you expect for free? Right? The reason why I'm going through all this is because Black Friday coming around on Thursday or Friday, and you're going to get all these good buys. You got to read the stuff very carefully. Read the fine print. Understand what you're buying. I have two philosophies in buying computing equipment. One is very simple. Buy what you need, because if you try to buy for 5 years from now, 2 years from now, you're going to be able to buy it cheaper. And unlike the old days, I remember with film cameras, you buy a camera and it'll last, the product life cycle is 5, 6, even more years. With digital cameras from the same manufacturer, like Sony is a good example, right? They introduced the A6300 earlier this year. And just recently, within, 7, 8 months, they introduced the A6500. It's like, hey, you know, they don't wait a whole year. Competition, as fierce as it is, they start coming out with changes right away. So on Black Friday, just remember that if it's too good to be true, make sure it really is true. And if you can't verify it, you don't have to buy it. And don't worry about the buy that you miss, because there will always be another buy. And by the way, one other thing is that, have you noticed that almost no one talks about Cyber Monday? I remember back a long time ago, Black Friday was something the day after Thanksgiving on a Friday, obviously they call it. And they call it Black Friday is because that's when the retailers really are able to have lots of sales, maybe at lower cost, but they make up their profit in volume. And then gradually over an evolutionary period of time, they started opening the doors on Thursday, which is Thanksgiving. And before you know it, when Halloween came around, you know what? They got these pre-Black Friday sales. And then when the internet came around in full force in 2005, we had what is called Cyber Monday. Notice no one talks about Cyber Monday anymore, because now Cyber Monday is like Black Friday. It starts right after Halloween. And now I've been reading a lot of these so-called pre-Black Friday ads. I'm going to tell you, be very careful reading it. And I'll name names, okay? I saw a Black Friday ad from Micro Center for a Raspberry Pi Zero board for $5 on sale. Wait a minute. That's a regular price. Yes, they're not lying. It's on sale. Just because they say it's pre-Black Friday sale, they're right. Is it on sale? Yeah, they're right. They didn't tell you it was a big discount on it, but don't get carried away. So you better know your prices. And my advice is, unless you got to do your homework. The typical American is they have this urge to buy things because it's on sale. And when you ask them, why did you buy it? It was on sale. I couldn't pass it up. I was watching TV the other day. There's a great TV program called Hoarders. And people are buying things, and they still got the price tag on it. They got the label, the packing on it. It's amazing how people, because it's on sale. Well, let's see if you can have that restraint. During the course of the year, I attend about half dozen press conferences, and there are many products there that I look at for the first time, and I get a better understanding of what it can and can't do, and I report back to the listeners. And what's been happening in the past couple of years is that many of these new products are really the products that are trying to get to market. They need funding, first of all, and you've probably heard the term kickstart or crowdfunding. And in many cases, in fact, in more than half the cases, most of the products I see never get to market, and yet they raise money. You wonder, where is the money going to, and what can you expect from all this crowdfunding or kickstart projects? So I asked Marty Winston, who is allied in this field, to give me a commentary on this.
I want to take you back in history. Let's go back to, the Edwardian or Victorian era in jolly old England, when, as you walk down the streets and alleyways, the beggars are there with their hats out, saying, "Please, mister, please, spare a shilling, spare a penny, spare half a crown. I can't eat, my kids can," the whole panhandling thing. You don't have to go back in history for that. Go in any major city, and for that matter, outside a lot of convenience stores. There are still panhandlers, people asking you for something and really not returning much of anything. Do you feel good for donating? How about a day later? Do you still feel good for donating? I mean, you can donate through a church or organized charity, and that's fine. I even object to going to a grocery store where they say, "Do you want to give $5 to the food bank?" I give more than that to the food bank, but I really don't like ambush charity. Now, I'm not saying that crowdfunding is ambush charity. You're going to a crowdfunding site because you want to. You're volunteering your presence there. You're going to take a look at whatever it is. You really want to spend money on it? What do you get in return? You're not getting shares of stock. You're not getting equity. You may or may not get the product that they claim to want to build and sell. And, is that any different from panhandling? Hey, let's be definitive about it. No, it isn't any different from panhandling. Crowdfunding is panhandling. It's asking for charity. It's asking for charity without the usual diligence that marketing and product development tend to go through. And you should be very, very wary of this stuff. You know, the guy thinks he's got, or lady, go either way, the inventor thinks he's got, or she has, the world's cleverest product to do something that's never been done before. Why hasn't it ever been done before? Is it possible that the idea is stupid? Well, can't be. Mom said, "That's very nice. That's very smart. You should do something with that, but not on my money." It's wacky, the things you see there. You know, the first umbrella with a tongue hanging out. What use is that? I made that up. I didn't see that anywhere. I don't know that it's not there. But the things that they're offering, number one, sometimes can't be done. Number two, they're terrible at estimating their costs, so you don't know what the actual price will be when they build it and try to sell it, or whether it will have any market presence. But what do you care? You don't own a share in it. That thing does remarkably well, and you don't get a penny back. All you're getting is a perceived discount in the one thing that they're promising as their gift for your investment in their dream. So what do? You know, they say, we only need $15,000. We only need $3,000. Why do they do that? They're hoping to get a heck of a lot more. In fact, they're very often putting that much money into a professional PR term to try to pimp participation by the media in promoting the site, and pimp is not an inappropriate word here. So what is the value of panhandling? It's a balance. It's a terrible balance, but it's a balance. Some good ideas get off the ground, but let's be very specific. Not many. Give you a little bit of background so you can know this is not just attitude. There's some experience here. When you spend $6.95 for a product in a store, if the vendor of that product has to pay more than a dollar to make that product, they will lose money. What? 7-1 and they're losing money? Yes. The reason has to do with the margin that the store takes, the margin that the distributor takes, the margin that the sales rep takes, the cost of building the product, the cost of bringing the product to market, and any payment of overhead, profits, salaries, or anything else the company tends to take out of it. Roughly, you can think in sevenths. 1/7 goes to build the product. 1/7 covers all the cost of overhead, anything they'll ever get out of it. 1/7 has to go to marketing. 4/7 go to the resale channel. So if you are crowdfunding and it costs you X and you're going to say that it'll be for sale for anything less than 7X, you're rigging yourself for failure. That's just not going to work. Now, people say, well, I don't need to do that. I'll put it on my own website. Let's have a little experiment here. How many people can spell quintessence? See, and that's a known word. But what if I spell quintessence with a W for my product? How are you going to know that? Are you going to remember the word when you leave? We could be in front of 100 million people on the radio, not this show, but we can be in front of 100 million people on the radio saying, come and see us at quintessence.com. I don't know if there is such a site, but come and see us at quintessence.com. And unless you can remember that word, unless you can know how to find it if it's not spelled normally, you're never going to get there. Traditional media reach significantly more people than online media. And traditional media don't have anything you can click on. You can't click on your TV set, you can't click on your radio, you can't click on a magazine, you can't click on a newspaper. The largest online sites, according to people I've talked to who are experts at measuring this, may have an aggregate set of eyeballs reaching tens of millions of people. And that's not an unreasonable claim. Some of them do. Some of the largest sites that you know for news and information that are web-specific are reaching 3 to 5 million. And that's a real number for the whole site. Better results with things that are doppelgangers for existing major media. NewYorkTimes.com, for example, is brilliant at getting a lot of people to their online presence. They're very good at that. It's very efficient. But for the other guys, I want you to know that the actual measurements of audience show that even with allegedly tens of millions of people at the site, individual articles tend to be seen by fewer than 20,000. In fact, often far fewer than 20,000. And there's research from the era of direct mail that says if you're not reaching at least 40,000, you can project fewer than one sale as a result. So consider that the generation looking at a crowdfunding is more likely to be younger than older. There are other older people who go there, and they tend to regard, and you may be one of them, you tend to regard play money as what you're dealing with. If you think the product is cool and you'd like to get one and you think the crowdfunding site offer is reasonable, you put the money out there, you forget about it. It's like leaving a big fat tip at Christmas or doing that kind of thing. It's money you've spent because you've elected to spend it, and that's fine. If you're making an aware decision to spend the money on crowdfunding or on anything else, playing the ponies, I don't care. If you're making an aware decision, that's your decision. Let's assume you're a grown-up, you're taking responsibility for it. That's absolutely fine. But like so many who go into crowdfunding, it's also important that it never be an unaware decision. Don't go in thinking that you have any ownership in anything, that there's any payback for anything, and really don't hold an expectation that you're actually going to get the product they're talking about building, let alone getting it anytime soon. The time it takes to come to market for a new product that has the backing of a real company, a real organization, should be 18 months. It's often less. It's not often much less, and it's almost never less for newcomers. So we have the issue of getting it priced right. We have the issue of presenting it accurately. We have the issue of not having experience in the manufacturing processes and their timing and their actual costs. Tooling for a plastic mold is $35,000. And is that in what they figured? Often not. And then the retooling, when it doesn't quite feel right, you're not going to get that for free. Well, I don't like it. Well, goodbye. Yeah, that's not an easy thing. So when the people offering the product don't know the numbers and you're deciding to put money into it, just make sure you know you could be wasting your money, because crowdfunding is panhandling.
Thank you, Marty. Marty Winston is the editor of newstips.com. It's a bulletin, and he is also a contributor to the Personal Computer Show. Just a couple of quick public service announcements. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will be having a presentation on Riding the Mobile Digital Revolution Tuesday, November the 29th, that's next week, at 7 p.m., Building MAS, Room 100, at the Brookdale Community College in Lincroft, New Jersey. The Westchester PC User Group will be meeting Thursday, December 1st, 7 p.m., Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor, White Plains, New York. The Icon PC User Group will be having a presentation on Fabulous Freeware, Friday, December the 2nd. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Brentwood Public Library, 2nd Avenue and 4th Street, Brentwood, Long Island. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will be meeting on Friday, December 2nd at 8 p.m. Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on cable TV cord cutting on Tuesday, December the 6th. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m. Meeting location is Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Computer Learning Center at Ewing Community Room will have a presentation on the Mobile Digital Revolution on Tuesday, December the 6th at 2 p.m., and they will meet at 999 Lower Ferry Road, Ewing, New Jersey. And finally, the New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on Thoroughly Modern MIDI. It's an overview and a demo, Thursday, December 8th at 7 p.m. at NYU 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 414. And all these meetings are free, open to the public. Enough talking on this end. We have listeners lined up who are calling into the show, and let's get to the first one. Bajun from Brooklyn, how are you? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show.
Very well, thank you. My question to you is about a tablet I recently bought. It has 1 gig RAM, and basically I noticed I'm using Wi-Fi with it, and I noticed the Wi-Fi is like 18 megabits compared to my laptop. It will be like 54. And I'm not doing anything, just reading. No windows are open, and therefore, why is the speed slower on the tablet than on the laptop?
Because you got 1 gig memory. Because on a typical computer, you have, easily.
Four, yeah.
You're talking about in 8 gigabytes. Okay,
right.
4 gigabytes. You're mm-hmm. talking about gigabytes, okay?
Right.
In fact, the lowest memory for a notebook is 2 gigabytes. And you're talking about one.
Yeah.
Very low. So basically, you can only do one thing at a time. You can't multitask on it, and you're not able to. But it was probably a very low-cost tablet, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, let me just say that that was one of the complaints that people had when the Apple came up with a new tablet, is that the 16 gigabytes was just barely enough to contain iOS, and you really need 32 to do anything. So you could next time you buy another tablet, make sure there's sufficient memory, ask around, and if you happen to have someone, a youngster, be it grandchild or daughter or son, mm-hmm. it's called trickle-down.
Okay. All right, then.
Okay.
Thank you for... Next, one more thing. Can you talk about hotspots, those hotspot equipment, sometime in the future or now, whatever, whenever you have time?
I got that scheduled, by the way. And yes,
okay.
I do. Because that's something that, in terms of cord cutting, in terms of portability and so on, I think we're really don't have to be tethered, but I did a study on it and I looked at the pricing and I just felt that to talk about with Black Friday and all these sales, I want to address the other items first.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you very much for that call,
Julie. Goodbye.
Okay, we're ready for the next one to call. Let's get on to the next caller, Max. Who do we have?
We have Dakia from Edison.
Akia?
Dakia.
Dakia, yeah. How are you? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. How can we help you?
I just wanted to know, what's better? Is it the MacBook Air? Is it better to buy the MacBook Air or the MacBook Pro?
Well, it depends how you plan on using it. In other words,
for a college student.
You're a college student?
Yeah. So it's more durable. I walk around campus.
Yeah.
Better, storage.
Okay, let me answer the question. I'll answer this way, all right? Your first concern is budget and which is the one you can afford. And if you can afford...
And particularly when your parents are paying for it.
Oh, I just hope your mom and dad is not hearing this, okay? But now, if affordability is not an issue, seriously, though, that should be the first question is what can you afford? If it's a lower-cost unit, obviously, you know, you go with that. The second is to, I understand what you're saying because with college kids and because I meet a lot of them at NYU, they take a beating, okay? Now, the thing that I would look at very carefully is which one has the longest battery, in other words, battery usage. Because I find that with many of the schools, they don't put AC outlets in the classroom anymore. They only have one for the professor or maybe two. Because in the old days, everyone's fighting to get to an AC outlet.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
So the second thing I would look at that would be a factor is which one would have the longest battery life for you to use. Okay. And then the third factor is if they're both equal or you can live with one having less than the other is weight, because it's like carrying another book. You know, I don't care if it weighs 1 pound, 2 pounds when you have to carry it all day long.
It's so heavy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, unless you have a boyfriend that can carry it for you.
No, not approved.
And there's one thing that I do want to stress, though, okay, is that don't buy for the future. Because it's always be cheaper, you can get it a little later, and that's a mistake because people spend a lot of money to buy for future they don't use. Electronics change very rapidly, new features, new functions. So those are the three rules I give you, and I hope that you do well in school.
Oh, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you for calling.
All right.
Okay, all right. And good luck with your studies.
Thank you.
Well, Shane is back.
Oh, Shane.
From Manhattan.
Oh, wait a minute. As what someone would say, money-making Manhattan, and I assume you're making money.
No, I'm not.
No?
That's a dream.
Oh, wait a minute. You are spending money then?
No.
You're not even helping the economy?
No, I'm not. I'm sorry to say I'm helping them by my participation in being a really active citizen advocate.
Oh, okay. And you have a commentary or question for us tonight?
Yes, I do. Someone I know is buying a laptop for the first time, mm-hmm. and because I have a computer and a tablet, they asked what I thought about it. And there are some things I actually don't know, so I don't know what to say to them.
So what's the question?
The question is, I know what the display size is. I don't understand the display resolution, which is 1366 mm-hmm. By 768.
Right.
And they're getting this deal on, I will not say, a home shopping network for like about four, in the middle 400s. Mm-hmm. And I don't want them to get a piece of junk. And I know that computers have improved so much over the last few years that perhaps it's fabulous. I think it might be. But the selling point for them was lifetime support.
Yeah, whose lifetime are they talking about?
Well, that's exactly what I don't understand. It's an HP, and I've had really good luck with my HPs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but now, I'm not sure about this particular model. I have all the specs in front of me, but I don't know what to tell you that would help you to know.
The 1366, I think by, I forgot, was it 7 something?
768.
Yeah, that is a minimum requirement although you can go low in that, but that's really the specified minimum requirement for Windows 10. And if you're talking about 11-inch screen,
fine. No, it's a 15.6-inch screen.
It's usable on a 15-inch, but you'll find that you should try to get something higher resolution than that, okay?
I know that.
Because
what I was afraid of.
Because what it really is, all right, is when they give that, if you multiply the length and width in terms of number of pixels.
Yes.
It's a fixed number of pixels. So if you put, let's say you put X pixels into a small screen, it looks one way. But if you use the same number of pixels in a larger screen, then they look loose. So the small screen, you could go with a lower resolution. Higher screen, the penalty on that is when you're the ability to look at smaller font text. Okay. In other words, if you do a lot of editing, you really want a higher resolution so that you can get more onto the screen. If you're doing spreadsheet work like accounting and so on, you mm-hmm. want to have more information on the screen. So, yes, you can run with lower resolution on a 15-inch, but if your functional requirement is to be able to look at detail, to get more information on the screen because you've got some processing to do, you want to be able to have a higher display.
But you don't think it would be a bad for a person who doesn't have an internet connection at home and is taking their laptop to the library, you don't think it would be a bad computer to have to just look up the price of things or do the research?
If you live in New York, you just use a library machine. Why even carry it around?
Well, that's it. That's what I'm wondering, if this is worth the purchase of $450.
Well, let me put it this way. If this pride in ownership, then buy
yes.
it. But if you don't have that silly pride of ownership and you could use a library machine,
mm-hmm.
Save your money and buy yourself a better unit when you can do it.
That's kind of what I was thinking. This thing should arrive in a few weeks.
Oh, wait
and
a minute. You bought it already?
No, I think what he basically needs is some kind of basic unit that will function properly
My basic recommendation is he should try to use some machine so he has an idea of what he or she really wants to use the machine for. Because, it's like you don't want to buy a car without driving it at least a couple of times to know what it's like to go on a trip or how much stuff you can carry. Until you actually use something, reading about it, hearing about it, doesn't give you an accurate assessment of what the product really is.
Right. So when this comes from this particular home shopping network, I think you can use it for 30 days and then send it back.
Well, that's up to you, okay?
No, I wouldn't want to do that, but it's a possibility. I don't know how else you can test drive a computer.
Well, I would go to the stores. You go to the library, find out what machine they're using, and just run it. Or you go to a friend, and, I have a better idea.
I've showed them my laptop, but mine is like a pretty good one. And even my tablet was $500-something. And it's fabulous.
Okay.
But I know the resolution is higher than this.
Well, you know what? It's they got to go kick the tires, okay?
Okay. That's what I'll tell them.
Okay.
I'll tell them try to figure that out. Thank you so
much. Okay. Thank you for calling. Martha, welcome to the Personal Computer Show. And how can we help you with your commentary or your question?
Thank you very much, Hank. I have a quick question. I heard you speaking about a hard drive. I purchased a passport, one of those my passports, just to mm-hmm. back up my unit.
Okay.
Quick question. Should I leave it plugged in all the time so that it's on a schedule to back up? Because I tend to unplug it and back it up once a week.
Well, when you say you unplug it, is your computer on all the time?
Yes.
Well, let me give you the upside and the downside, okay?
Okay.
And it's all theoretical. It's like a light bulb, all right? If you keep flicking the light bulb on and off when you need it and don't use it, but then they say theoretically, you have less usage on the bulb, but that clicking on and off, the powering on and off, there is a surge, and that can contribute to shortening life of it. Okay, so now my recommendation is, If you're using it only for a selective time of the day or time of the week,
mm-hmm.
You don't have to unplug it, but just make sure there's no power to it. Okay. In other words, if it's connected directly to the USB port and it's being powered by the USB port, then I would unplug it. And let me give you my reason for it, all right? Because if you happen to come across any malware or you're on the internet and they go searching through your system, hey, you know what? That's a tremendous liability because you have all that information that's backed up, that is historical, that is not on your current system, but you may install on, you know, like your you know, the whatever old returns are. You may have passwords on it.
That's the reason I unplug it.
So now there are units where they are much larger in capacity, and you actually, you know, there's a little switch for, you know, AC on and off. That, or you just, you know, you don't have to physically unplug it. You just turn off the power. So does it hurt the system? Let me answer the question this way. Does it hurt the system to leave it on or constantly take it on and off? I don't think it matters.
I
don't think it matters one way or the other. But from a practical point of view of security, if you're not using it, unplug it.
That's exactly what I do. Thank you so much, Hank. And I've got one more quick question because it's been in my head for years.
Okay.
When one has a CD, say, for instance, a blank CD, you put it in your computer and you want to, say, write a book. And you immediately save that blank disc with a name. And then you start typing your information into that disc. Now, I remove that disc and put it in my safe so no one can see my book. Does the information that I typed on the computer, now mind you, I've already saved everything on that blank disc, so I'm not saving it on my computer, per se. Does it still register on the computer? I mean, will it be stored? You know how it automatically saves stuff when you walk away.
Okay. Let me answer this way, all right?
Yeah.
If you carefully remove the optical media, because it could be a DVD or CD and so on, so I use the term optical media. If you carefully remove it from the drive and you put it into some kind of a folder or envelope and so on, put it in a safe, there should be no problem at all because there's no handling on it. Now, the only question I want to raise is, why don't you use a USB flash drive?
I could use that. I could use that too, either or. My question was simply, does my computer save it if I'm not saving it, you know, physically saving it on that particular computer? I'm saving it on a flash drive or on a disk. I just, you know, because you have hackers. People can get into your computer.
Yeah.
I don't have a hacker, but people can get into your computer, and I just don't want any trail that, you know, that they can see.
Well, let me put it this way. If you are very careful with your optical media, the so-called, and I use the word so-called because it's all done by simulation, and that's one of the things I did want to talk about, but I guess I'll do that next week. You know, it's like how many times can you open the door before you wear out the lock, and how many times, okay, is that they say that the theoretical life of an optical drive, media, is 70 years.
Ooh.
Now, the problem is I won't be around 70 years from now.
Neither
to know.
Will I, Hank.
and the other thing, which is just as silly, is the optical drive may no longer be available for me even to read the media. Okay. So, by the way, anytime you change your media, you know, whatever peripheral you use, whatever you save, you got to go through the whole process of rewriting it. Otherwise, you're going to have to find a way of saving the equipment.
Right. Gotcha.
Okay.
Gotcha.
All right. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you so much.
And have a happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. You as well, dear.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
And I think we got time for one more call. Caller, and we'll try to make this quick because I have to get off in 2-3 minutes. Julie, welcome to the Personal Computer Show, and how can we be of assistance to you?
I'm calling to ask you about the probable security of the computers used in the elections and the swings.
Did you hear the show last week? Oh, she hung
up? Appears as though she hung up.
Oh, well, let me put it this way. If she's no longer on, let me just say that the we had Dr. Rebecca Mercury on. In fact, that's one of the things we did talk about. And for those who might have missed it, because there's also the podcast of it on PRN.FM. It's very interesting, and she talks about how secure or unsecure it may be. Now, it varies by state. Some states have it in a more secure manner. Some states don't. But her the general gist is there's not that much security, unfortunately. Well, you know what? Time is up. You can contact me at hank@pcradio.org. Or if you have a question that you haven't been able to get on the air with, or if you have a public service announcement for me to make, you could contact us at our website. The website for the Personal Computer Show is www.pcradioshow.org. And we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing. And back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Until we meet again, same time, same station, next week, and have a happy Thanksgiving and good night.